you again for coming to our geovisualization seminar. We have another terrific speaker for you today. I'm very pleased to introduce Professor Rob Edsel from Arizona State University. Rob is one of those GI scientists, geographic information scientists, that I've kind of admired from afar. So I actually wanted to make sure that we invited Rob so that we could hear his work, but also so that I could spend some time with him in person, which I immensely enjoyed doing today. Rob is, I think he's one of those Renaissance people. He's got a very interesting background. His first degree was in music from Kenyon College in Ohio, and then he took a master's degree in meteorology from Penn State University. He then stayed at Penn State to get his PhD in geography, finally finding your niche. And he's another one of Alan McEachran's students, so those of us who are familiar with the geovisualization world are becoming more familiar with it, know how important the work of Alan McEachran is and of his students. And so Rob is another one of those products. He was also an office mate of Mark Harrower, who was our first speaker. So you can see the connections there. We're actually going to have a Penn State faculty member come to speak to us a little later on in the series also. But Rob has gone on to serve as an assistant professor at Arizona State University. He has been there for several years and on the cusp of getting tenure with flying colors. And he's been doing groundbreaking research in cartographic visualization, spatial analysis, numerical analysis. He works with cognition. We're going to hear a little bit about some of that work today in that realm. He's been very involved in the International Cartographic Association Commission on Visualization, and has done a lot of work with the Association for American Geographers. He was also a Nystrom Award finalist, so his dissertation was judged as being one of the best in geography during that year that he defended his dissertation. And then recently he received a Centennial Professor Award at Arizona State University for, I quote, his realistic and proven dedication to the community and his ability to demonstrate why geography matters, which I think is a wonderful award. And he's going to share with us today why geovisualization matters, and certainly why human activity in visualization matters and is very important. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Rob Edsel.
Thank you, Dawn, for that nice introduction, and I also just want to thank you for including me in this lineup that you've got of geovisualization specialists, many of whom I admire from afar, and it's been really, when I saw the lineup you all have come in, it's really very much an honor to be a part of it, and I certainly have enjoyed being here at Corvallis and talking to you all, each one of you that I've met thus far, and those that I hope to meet over some beers later. What I want to talk to you about today is my philosophy on visualization, geovisualization specifically, or geographic visualization. I think it's really fun and sexy to say that you're making all kinds of really great graphics and making three-dimensional models and animations and interactive dynamic representations of the Earth's surface. Cartography, as we'll see today, has had a long history of being quite user-centered in its research, very much concerned about the reader of the map, and lots of the technology, and I bet many of you who work in technology can attest to this. Technology advances so rapidly that often the user gets left behind, and some of the technology that's developed is developed without any consideration of whether or not it's useful, usable, basically without the kind of responsible academic rigor of its development that we'd like to see. And so I'm going to talk to you today about some of the cognitive and, well, the human activity of visualization. And I want to stress that visualization, as a term, implies a very human activity. You will probably hear, and I don't have any particular problem with this, but it's not the way I approach it, you'll probably hear in these seminars the use of the word visualization as a noun describing something you see on the screen. This is a visualization of a car crashing into a computer-simulated pole. It's a visualization of the climate system of the world. I tend not to use the word visualization as a noun in that respect. What visualization is to me is it's a process. It's a mental process. It's a methodology, perhaps. It's an activity of interacting with a computer-represented display of geographic space, if it's geovisualization, but it could be scientific or abstract information visualization. And it's an interactivity between a human and a computer. So what happens in visualization is that the visualization happens here. It doesn't happen here. The visualization happens in the user's mind. And as such, it is a very much a cognitive activity of perception, recognition, cognition. And these sorts of active verbs here. We're learning, connecting, gaining insight, generating hypotheses, constructing knowledge. It's so noble. Constructing knowledge from visualization. But it's all up here. It's all stuff that happens in the mind. And to me, visualization is not just pretty pictures. It's not just technology. Technology is obviously vital for it. And it's not just maps. There are all kinds of other things that I do other than maps that I consider visualization. In fact, lots of ways of representing text on a map or a text in a graphic is considered visualization in some fields. So I want to emphasize about that's the theme that runs through most of my work. I tend to like to think of the human side, the human user, the reader of these representations. Visualization environments is another way you can talk about these sorts of systems that we're designing. So this is Cartography Cubed, Alan McEachran's now pretty classic representation of how maps are used and how maps work. Essentially in geography, with three different axes. We have an audience, private to public, so one person to a lot of people. We have the level of interactivity of the representation. Either you have a real highly interactive representation or something that doesn't really change very much, a static map. And then we also have this axis in the depth where you're finding out things about the data. Sometimes you're trying to communicate known things about the data, other times you're trying to discover unknown things about it. And cartographic visualization is sort of a process that starts perhaps here and goes to here, but it sometimes gets stuck on one of these, and that's okay. Up here in the upper right corner, in the back right corner, we have data presentation, where we're designing a map for a lot of people, fairly low interactivity, something that's fairly permanent, something with low interactivity, and presenting known things. So communicating an idea. So this is sort of the data communication paradigm that has been talked about in cartography for a long time. You're communicating information from a scientist to a user. Well, visualization enables this exploration where we don't know what we're going to find. Okay, we don't know what we're looking for yet. We are exploring raw information to find relationships that have not been discovered yet. We're doing it with higher activity, using GIS, using geovisualization environments, using all kinds of statistical graphics. We're doing it basically by ourselves. Okay, there's one user creating something on a computer, interpreting it, matching with their own mental representations of the phenomenon, and then maybe altering the representation according to those mental perceptions. And so you can have public visualization, you can have group collaboration and visualization, we'll talk about that in a minute, but pretty much most of what we consider geographic visualization is a private activity that happens with high interactivity, discovering unknown things and unknown relationships. Now, visualization is an extension of cartography. We're designing visual representations of geographic data. And cartography has been many things, but one of the things that is a good theme of cartography and history of cartographic research is that it's always had the reader of the map in mind. we deal with, we see all kinds of studies of perception. Okay, what we call psychophysical studies. Here's a stimulus, and we're stimulating some part of the brain, and we're reacting to that. Okay, we're showing maybe something like how the eye moves around a map, eye tracking research. So you sit with your head in one of these little contractions, and a little thing watches where you look on a map. It's fascinating, actually. Imagine we always start up here in the upper left of any map, and we then attend the center of the map and spend some time around some things that stick out at you because they're darker. Okay, those are perceptual studies, and were very popular in the 60s and 70s, and basically created a lot of the cartographic guidelines we have now. This is the CIE color model, which is completely perceptually based. Okay, we have colors that are mapped according to color space. I don't need to get into that now. We have perceptual scaling of proportional symbols. All these studies of static maps. This is a cognitive representation. Boy, it's kind of hard to see back here. I'm sorry, but this is being able to see patterns that actually aren't there, or see relationships. This is a square that shows up. It's called a gestalt kind of thing, where you're seeing patterns in random chaos, and that's something that the human mind is very good at, and we take advantage of in cartography. And we have things like, how many colors can you see? Okay, what color, how do we handle hue versus value of colors? These are all sort of the kinds of psychophysical and cognitive studies that have categorized, or that can be, that characterized cartography research of the last 40 or 50 years. Well, it turns out that visualization, because, like I said at the outset, is very technologically dependent, hasn't kept up with this sort of research, because the technology has advanced so quickly that we're trying to build new tools very quickly, but we haven't really understood how these sorts of, how we perceive dynamic graphics and how we perceive interactive environments and how they can be useful and usable. So to create good visualization environments, we need to attend to the user's needs, we need to have usability studies, we need to have the kind of proof of the effectiveness of these things that we're promoting in order to be academically rigorous. We need to say, yeah, in fact, what you have just designed, what you've just seen, is an improvement over that topographic map that's on a page that you sit and look at in front of, on a table in front of you. There's an improvement there. And we have to be rigorous, and we have to do human subjects testing. It's kind of difficult sometimes, but in fact it's beginning to percolate into the visualization community. There was an article, as you can see very clearly back behind this table, in the most recent Annals, from Andy Griffin and some colleagues who are doing a comparison of static maps versus and small multiples versus animated representations of the same thing, and doing a comparison of the two. And that's the kind of research that that I'm advocating here. So when we're doing usability studies like this, basically visualization is by definition something that has to do with the computer. And the computer could be this computer, it could be this computer, it could be this computer, it could be this computer. It could be the computer that flips down on your visor in 10 years, so that as you're walking around the world, you have information in front of you on that computer that you have in the back of your hat. You can imagine all the different display devices that you need for visualization in the world today. Okay? We have all kinds of potential for not just this computer or the computer that is in a lab, but we're seeing computers in cars, we're seeing computers in iPods, okay, all sorts of things where we're going to have all kinds of different devices that are going to be used to encourage visualization and creative thinking. And we look, because this is a computer, we look to psychology and the realm of human-computer interaction. turns out that this is a really interesting, rich, interdisciplinary field, basically of psychologists and computer scientists, but that study how we understand things that are displayed on a computer. How, as we interact with a computer, we are gaining knowledge. It's cool. I really like this stuff, the human-computer interaction stuff. And an early expert in human-computer interaction was Geert Hofstede, who says that each user has a set of established patterns in thinking and feeling and acting that govern how new information is understood and assimilated. Okay, so each one of you, if you were to look at the same image, would have a different interpretation of that image. Okay, because you all come from different experiences, different backgrounds, different cultures. So we still, with human-computer interaction, there is an emphasis on the user. Okay, not on the technology, but on the user. Okay, and as I mentioned before, these individual differences are very important as visualization is a private activity. They're very important now more than ever because so much of the world is under the spell of computers, okay? Visualization can now happen globally. It's a global village. But does that mean we have to design the same way for everyone in this global village? Perhaps not, especially if our intention is to have people think creatively. And if we acknowledge that people's differing backgrounds could actually be used to our advantage in coming up with solutions to problems. Okay, so what we want to do in visualization is to encourage people to think creatively about the phenomenon or the phenomena that are represented. Okay, so this is sort of the holy grail, from my point of view, of geographic visualization, is the encouragement of out-of-the-box, creative thinking, insight generation, hypothesis generation, seeing that, aha, I never saw that before kind of thing. And in fact, you're the only person, you're the first person who has seen that particular relationship. That particular aha moment is what we all, as visualization designers, would love to have happen. It's not something that I, as a cartographer, would particularly be good at. I don't know the phenomenon that I'm mapping. All right? It's one of those, I'm trying to facilitate this kind of activity for domain experts who actually are going to use this environment. So in human-computer interaction, we have things like user profiles and use profiles, where we're identifying typical users of geovisualization and typical uses of geovisualization. And as we mentioned before, these are individuals. The users are typically individuals. We can have collaborative geovisualization, and in fact, I think Mark Gagan, when he comes, will probably talk to you a little bit about some of the projects they're doing with collaborative geovisualization. So geovisualization in a group, either in the same place with different avatars or in different places, remote geovisualization. But what I've done thus far is designed for individuals. And those individuals are typically experts, which frees me up nicely into not making things too terribly simplified, which is one of the biggest challenges of cartography in general, is getting things in a format so that they're simple for the most people to understand. Well, if you're designing for individuals and experts, it might not be that important that you, I don't want to say dumb things down, but simplify enough so that the maximum number of people can understand them. Typical uses of geovisualization, as I mentioned, that bottom left corner, exploration of data, finding unknown things and not necessarily communicating things that are known. Deliberating, not thinking too quickly. Okay, if you're designing an experiment in usability, one of the things that's often done is say, how quickly can you find this thing on the website? Okay, websites are full of usability engineering. Marketers love to know if you can find that one product in the website that is going to be the thing that you're going to buy. So finding that spot, finding that thing in the shortest amount of time is typically a very is a goal for usability engineering and website design. It's not in geovisualization. In fact, one of the things that we kind of want to encourages people to spend a little time thinking creatively about the things that we're representing. Okay? So in that same way, we don't want people to think conventionally. We don't want people to think in a way that conforms to a certain data model that we're imposing on them. Okay. So, in terms of what I've been up to recently, a usability test for a visualization environment was carried out by me and someone that some of you might be familiar with, Kelly Larson, who's an Oregon State Geosciences graduate. She is now at Arizona State, and we've worked together on an assessment of what is ASU is calling the decision theater. Okay, and the decision theater, if you go to their website, is one of those multi-million dollar projects where we have a semi-immersive environment, 270 degrees around, 7 or 8 screens, with animated representations that are three-dimensional, that fly in, make you a little sick. You know, you're like, oh, there comes another surface, and over here is some color splashing all over the place. And what we intended to do was to figure out how such an environment helps making decisions. If it does, and to what extent it facilitates decision making. It's called the decision theater. Okay, we're looking to assess its value. So what did we do? We created a comparative, and that's actually a little bit dicey, because it's kind of hard to have a comparable presentation, but we tried to create one for a PowerPoint presentation in a classroom, just like this. Okay, we created still images, we took screen captures from the presentation that existed for the decision theater and presented it in a classroom. We got some decision makers, folks from the community, and we got also had some students serve as the users, and our uses was the exploration of these environmental surfaces. They were the urban heat island around Phoenix and the water table underneath Phoenix. So complex three-dimensional surfaces. One was abstract, the temperature surface, and one was physical, the depth of the water table. And not too surprisingly, our results showed that there was a difference, but that the difference was primarily affective, not effective. And I don't know if that's really, that's a little glib. But the 3D environment, the decision theater, made people excited about making decisions. The two-dimensional environment of the PowerPoint presentation didn't. Okay? The decisions that were made and the information that was learned didn't change all that much. Okay? Folks learned about the same amount in both, but people were more excited about the decision theater. So the difference is kind of predictably affective. Okay? It's more emotional. Okay, then really quantifiable, and this, we took both qualitative and quantitative measurements of it. I can talk to you about them later if you want. We did see that there were some things that the differences were dependent upon. First of all, if you had more experience with the subject, you were less likely to be excited about the decision theater. In fact, you were more likely to see its flaws. Okay, that kind of makes sense too. Although, it turns out that the people who get the most out of this are the folks that we call the Nintendo generation. Okay, it's people who are not necessarily domain experts, but who are experts in visualization, who understand how this is all generated and get excited about the three-dimensionality of it. They get a lot out of it. They're not nervous about it. They're not concerned about they're not overwhelmed by all of the stimulus they have. Okay, but the lay people, not so much. And the experts, actually, as it turns out, didn't gain all that much information from the 3D environment. Okay, there was also an interesting difference that we're going to investigate further about the type of phenomenon that was represented. There were two types of phenomenon, as I mentioned. There was the water resources with the physical topographic surface, where the depth of the water was actually a physical surface, although it was invisible, versus a statistical surface of temperature. Okay, the higher temperatures were high and the low temperatures were low, and it was a statistical surface that was invisible. Turns out that the 3D environment, the decision theater, had much better results with the abstract information. Okay, so the stuff that was invisible that's made visible here is more likely, it's a hypothesis, to be effectively represented in an immersive environment than something that is more physical. All right, so abstract does better than physical, perhaps. It's a good research question for geovisualization. Okay, maybe that's where our energy should go, is the representation of invisible abstract things. Okay, we also had expertise in terms of the spatial visual ability of people. We did one of the very classic block rotation tests to see how well people think spatially. And it turns out that the better spatial thinkers did better than the verbal thinkers. Okay? And that's another dimension that we need to investigate. Different types of learners might obviously learn differently with these representations. One thing that we lacked in this was user interaction in the decision theater. Obviously, that would have probably made the 3D model much more useful. But I do want to talk about this whole spatial versus visual thinkers thing. I was driving through Illinois a couple of years ago and came upon this sign. And it's one of the more complicated road signs I've ever seen. It had three little things on the, three little side roads. And they were labeled Campground Road, Norway Road, Nursery Road. Okay? So the question is, which one is which? All right? And it turns out I happened to be thinking about this that day, and sure enough, I did cut it off, but over here, the first road you come to is Campground Road. Okay? Which corresponds to this road, right? Because you read the sign going up, and you read the words going down. Okay? Weird. And obviously, I think this is the most anyone's looked at this this sign, but we want to be able to accommodate folks who think in different conventions than we do. And I like the idea of cartographic conventions as being good building blocks for our mental conceptualization of geographic phenomena. We use these cartographic conventions of north equals up, for example. Okay, that's a convention that doesn't have to be. I'll show you a few more here. Top equals further, farther away. It's a distance, so it's farther away. Okay, but verbally, the top is closer to you, right? The top is the first thing you come to. All right, so this is a conflicting convention. And on Western maps, here are some of those classic cartographic conventions. Up equals more, okay, higher bars on thematic maps equals more. Darker equals more, okay. If you were just to show you a map with no legend, you would assume these things to be the case. You would assume that up is north, right is later. It's kind of an odd one, right? So on an animated map, the timeline moves from left to right. Why? Okay. Y-axis equals height, circle equals a cycle, so if you see a circle, something is periodic. Okay. We now are concerned about designing for diverse users and diverse uses, and for those folks to think creatively about a problem. So I did a little bit of user testing on an interface what we're concerned about with the research that I'm about to tell you about was the cultural factors that have to do with, well, we wanted to look at the right equals later thing. Okay, this is one of those things that came up in a, we were looking at some maps online that had, in this one map, an animated map, had a legend where the time started up here. The earliest time is on the top, and it went down to the bottom. That was the latest time. And that was very confusing to us, and we didn't know why. And we started hypothesizing about why that particular convention was screwing us up. And it was, we thought, perhaps a cultural factor. Perhaps we think left is earlier because we read from left to right. Okay, that's one way of thinking about it. It could also be that we're just used to Microsoft's interface. Okay, but the conventions and metaphors of Westerners might not be applicable to global users. Okay, all kinds of interesting conventions like those building blocks we saw. We red, of course, is a color of danger in the United States. Red is the color of happiness in China. It's the color of brides. Right? You never see a bride wearing red in the United States, but they all do. I shouldn't say they all do, but it's a traditional color of happiness in China. Had Japanese folks look at an animation of fish in a tank, and the same thing to Americans. Turned out that the Japanese attended to the scene more, attended to the fact that it was a clear bit of water, that the school of fish was moving in a certain way, that there was just more context in the scene. Whereas Americans, interestingly enough, focused on one fish and said that was a big fish. That fish moved quickly. That big fish in the middle did this. Context free, right? Imagine the implications for an animated map. Okay? If you're designing an animated map for a culture that is individualistic, like the United States, you might have a more, if we talk about GIS, discrete representation. More object-oriented, more vector-oriented. Whereas if we're doing something for a culture that is more collectivist, that's another term for this context-dependent culture, we might be more interested in sort of raster representations and representing the scene as a whole, or maybe we ought to go against the grain, represent things so that people think out of their normal habits. Okay, these are research questions that I don't know the answer to yet, but these are considerations that I think are useful in geovisualization research. Okay, some of you may know what these are, or certainly the one in the upper left is a little unusual. The stick map used in Polynesia. And in Polynesia, we don't really care too much about latitude and longitude. We care about currents. We care about where the islands are. We care about where the wind takes us. And that's what's represented on their maps of their world. Okay? So if you're designing something for a global audience, you might need to consider the kinds of experiences and the kinds of things that the users that you're designing for need. And it may not be boundaries and choropleth maps and latitude and longitude. Okay? It may be something much more abstract that folks that you're designing for use as their sort of reference. All right. Speaking of weird reference, this is New England, but turned so that west is up. This is in fact the very first map published in North America by a fellow named Hubbard, and I believe it was in early 1700s. It was in a book, at the inside cover of a book. And scholars for quite a while have wondered why west was up. And again, west was up, perhaps the same reason why that road sign said the farther away we get, the higher we go. We're approaching the new world from below. Okay? I've read a bit about this, and maybe this is kind of the wilderness, the unknown. There's resistance as you go up. It's kind of an interesting idea. But to the explorers into the new world, their perspective was inland was far. And down here in the coast, that's near. So orientation of the map might vary according to culture. So fortunately, lots of the stuff that I do, the users that I am concerned about for the stuff that I've done to this point, are experts, Westerners, folks that are in the lab next to me. Okay, I'm not particularly focused yet, although I'd like to be, on designing for a global audience. The experts that I've done some of the things for are just folks like meteorologists, who, by the way, I think are the original geovisualizers. Meteorologists have been dealing with complicated maps with lots of rich information and their own symbol set for many, many years, animating their own maps by using crazy flip books and saying, wow, that high pressure system's moved a little bit each day. And they're very used to multiple representations, statistical graphics, linked graphics, kinds of things that geovisualization is all about. Okay. Experts, there's been quite a bit of writing about how experts differ from novices in terms of their information uptake and how they deal with graphical information. They're more likely to assist in the development of new tools, more likely to help you out if you're designing new tools with creative suggestions, okay? More likely to spend more time with new tools. They don't get frustrated as easily, but they still prefer their old ways of doing things. Okay, so designing for experts is a bit tricky because you're trying to show them new things that you know they want, but sometimes it's a little bit tricky to get them out of their own way of thinking. So this is one of the first visualizations that, I just used the word visualizations. This is one of the first animated maps that I showed some experts at Penn State when I was there the last couple of months of graduate school there. I worked with experts to try to figure out a good way of representing forecast data. So let me just show you this first. We have isobars and then a storm that is brewing and comes up the coast, indicated by this little red dot. Okay. So, turns out that the National Weather Service at the time put out three different numerical models, forecast models of the way the of the progress of synoptic conditions. And these three models diverged occasionally. We start at the beginning with initial conditions right here. This is when the forecast came out. And then over the course of the animation, we have 2 days worth of it. 2 days, no, 72 hours. 3 days worth of animation. Okay? 3 days worth of forecast. And the color behind it is how they diverged and where, which is really important. They diverged a lot, but it was also important where they diverged. They diverged over the ocean. They diverged over where they were trying to model the Alaskan low pressure system and things. And it turns out that this is one of the best forecast blizzards ever. This little red dot you'll see is almost always surrounded by either light pink or blue because the models converged completely throughout the forecast. So even here, which is probably about 2 days of the forecast, the models are all agreeing in this blue area, which is the center of the storm. Now, as the storm moves off the coast, the models diverge briefly and then return at the end. This is the final forecast, and you see that the only place where all the models converge is right there around the center of the storm. And in fact, State College, Pennsylvania, right here, was hit with a 18-inch blizzard. It was terrible. It was fun, but it was terrible. But we wanted to show how the forecasts agreed or disagreed. And the folks in the meteorology department got very excited about this, showing, instead of basically saying, I always go with this one model, or I really trust this model a lot, this was a very good indication of the amount of risk that was associated with this particular storm. All the models agreed very well, but if you were out here in in Salt Lake City. We're not really sure where this high pressure system was or if it's going to, so we were uncertain about the forecast here. That's a general thing that experts really want to see, which is uncertainty representations. Okay, lots of the data that we have, of course, in geography now is highly uncertain. Differences in day, differences in scale, differences in accuracy, resolution, and so on. And lots of the work that's being done in geovisualization is how to represent uncertainty. And experts tend to like uncertain information a lot more than novices. Novices just want you to tell them what's going to happen. Whether it's uncertain or not. So back a little bit to the human-computer interaction literature. We find a couple of discussions, although lots of the human-computer interaction literature is based on metaphor. We're designing the desktop metaphor there to make transparent what's happening inside our computer to a human user. We're designing metaphors like the trash can when we delete something. Okay? Turns out that for geovisualization, I'm not so sure that metaphors that are transparent are what we want. Metaphors, some folks say, tend to blinker the user into a certain way of thinking. Okay, putting folks in a box when we're actually trying to make them think creatively. Okay? So one of the ways we might be able to free users from being blinkered into a specific way of thinking is to design unconventionally. Okay? Design not necessarily poorly. We're not going to show someone a really bad map and ask them to interpret it, but we might ask them to interact with the map in ways that they don't expect. So I mentioned a little while ago about this interface test that I ran with one of my graduate students. In fact, I should say she ran it. I shouldn't say I did it. But we designed three different animations. One with the temporal indicator going from left to right, one from right to left, and one from top to bottom. We didn't do the bottom to top one. Okay? Because we didn't know any writing systems that went bottom to top. There might be some, but we wanted to see if there was a relationship between preference for these different temporal indicator directions and reading, native reading directions. So we got some multicultural classes where we tried to encourage folks who grew up in China, grew up in Israel, grew up in India, maybe learning Arabic, maybe learning Hebrew, maybe learning Mandarin, where the reading direction was different, to see if there was any relationships between preference of one of these and native reading language direction. No, turns out. But these are folks that we interviewed in the United States. One of my multi-million dollar grants that I'm going to get, we're going to fly all around the world and do this. I don't know. Wouldn't that be good? See if that actually makes a difference. But one of the kind of weird things that came out of this, though, people definitely preferred this one. Okay, the standard Microsoft Windows player left to right motion. Okay, time moved from left to right. But then we asked them questions about the phenomenon that they were looking at. And some of you may note the Baltimore-Washington animation that was created by the USGS about 15 years ago now. And we reordered it and did some things with it and didn't tell them it was population. For all they knew, it was some sort of disease outbreak or something. And so they didn't know what it was. And we asked them questions about like when it was that the diffusion phenomenon was at its peak and when it was at its lowest. Turns out that people did the best on those questions here, weirdly, and actually did second best here and did worst here. They answered the questions least accurately on the most familiar interface. Okay? They also answered most quickly here, which, as I mentioned before, is not what we are hoping for in geovisualization. We actually want to encourage thinking And this is the kind of thing that I'm talking about and perhaps designing something unconventionally. Designing something so that people are thinking creatively about it, maybe attending to it for a little longer and coming up with better solutions. I did another study where I simply asked people what percentage of the world is covered by water. And I showed half the people this and half the people this. This isn't really visualization, this is sort of more of an environmental perception cartography thing. Obviously north up, south up, this did a lot better. People looked at this and thought about it, and people said 70%, 65%, people said 50% here, okay? This is much better because people are, of course, you could also argue that the visual field tends to like it just a little bit above the center of the vision, and certainly most of this top area is covered with water, so maybe that was also an effect. But certainly response times are also higher here. So people were thinking about it. So maybe unconventional design might be the way we want to go with visualization to encourage creative thinking. Okay? I'm going to kind of skip ahead because I've got a couple more demos I want to show you before we go, but geovisualization philosophical area is cartography in the past has been considered positive science, very, very scientific. GIS has lots of numbers, lots of boundaries, lots of boxes that things are put into. Cartography has been accused of that to some extent as well. I shouldn't say accused. There's certainly a good reason for that kind of work. But one of the things that allows us to kind of break out of that out of the box thinking is user interaction. That's one of the things that geovisualization allows us to do. So that each one of you who's using a geovisualization interface or an environment can create representations that are important to you and that are useful to you. And that's done through interacting with the system, through adding and subtracting layers, through animating, and through the interactive capabilities there. So let me give you a couple of examples of that. An interactive animation that I created with the help of a land use expert, a woman who's working in Puerto Rico in determining land use change in a couple of barrios of Puerto Rico, and we worked together and determined what was it. I interviewed her a little bit and determined what was important for her to see, and we developed these fairly typical what we call stacked graphs, so that we see the proportion of each land use category. This is 100% here. We see that about 21% is given over to agriculture, and more like 60% is clear cut in 1937. And we then had other stacked graphs from the other times, but what we didn't see, we had several different time periods that we were looking at, 1963 to 1995, but what we couldn't see is the percentage of the clear-cut land that turned into the other classes. We just saw that in 1963, 40% was clear-cut and 20% was agriculture. We didn't know how much of which changed into what. So we created this little animation, which is interactive, which shows how much of each, what proportion of each original thing has changed by pulling out, and then what it's changed to. And that's the 1963 stacked graph, which, by the way, has some forest now. We see that forest has regenerated, and watch what happens here in terms of regeneration of forest. Lots of the clear-cut land becomes forest, but very little of the, in fact, none of the agricultural land becomes forest. That's an interesting insight that hadn't been noticed before. Okay? So it was clear cut that turned into forest. That was the big one. And then here we have agricultural land turning to pasture. All right, that's the kind of, it's one of those kinds of insights that I thought was pretty neat when she saw this and said, wow, it does, you can actually see that how much of the clear cut to confirm my correlation matrices and my confusion matrices that I've already created, but in tabular form, you can see it visually here. I'll run through this animation one more time, let you know what's going on. Start in 1937, you can watch what happens to the agricultural land that changes, goes to pasture, and a lot of the clear-cut land goes to forest, and then the big change is here in the 60s, where all that agriculture, all the agricultural land becomes pasture, and all that clear-cut land becomes forest. And we can stop and start it, restart it at the beginning, and examine specific sections as we'd like. Okay? I also want to quickly show you this environment that I created in ArcView a while back now, that includes a statistical graphic called the parallel coordinate plot, that I borrowed from information visualization and from statistical graphics, and created a system where this is, we call this multiple linked views. We have a core cleft map here, the parallel coordinate plot here, and a scatter plot. As it turns out, this will be a scatter plot when we put a second axis on it here. Right now it's basically a histogram. And this was for a project with the National Cancer Institute where we were correlating cancer and space and different types of cancer and different types of problems and over time. So this is spatial, it's temporal, in that these were time-based. This is 1980, 1986, 1983, I got those mixed up somehow, and 1990, I think. Different time steps. And each one of these lines traces the prostate cancer rate, for example, for 1980. This one is Deer Lodge, Missouri, up there, a little red dot up there. And it was real high in 1983. This is 1986. This is 83, I guess. So it goes down at 83, over here at 86. For some reason, those are reversed. I'm sorry about that. And 89. So you see it's highly variable. That's interesting. Why is it so highly variable in Deer Lodge, Missouri? Well, we can actually kind of take a look at some of the error involved in that and see that it is actually, one of these is error, one of these axes is error, and sure enough in 1980 it's a highly suspect reading. Turns out that if one person gets prostate cancer in a very small low population area, then the rate goes way up, right? But if one person gets prostate cancer in New York City, the rate barely changes. So the highly variable rate, if you have a lot less people, something that epidemiologists knew, but I didn't know. I mean, I suppose I could have figured it out. It turns out that if we go down here to places where we don't have a lot of variation, and we look on the map, we can look for spatial trends. Not much in the way of spatial trends with these areas that are highly certain. These are low error areas. And any geographers? Any idea how these are related to one another, these places? It turns out these are the cities. Okay? So it takes space, I could show you some temporal changes, it takes knowing a little something about epidemiological statistics, but these are the kinds of associations and insights that come together in geovisualization. And I showed someone this, that there was a big aha moment, lots of light bulbs went on at the National Cancer Institute, so I got all excited. It's kind of fun. So I want to just real quick wrap up with an idea for my future. And that is, and I was talking to John Kimmerling a little bit about this, I know he does this in his and his multimedia cartography, and that is incorporating sound. I Dawn said that I was a music major in undergraduate. And I love music. And gosh, music is one of those things that has a certain affective quality. One of the things that GIS doesn't do very well is give you that sense of emotion and affect. Okay? It's very cold. It looks like it's data. Gosh, that's hard data. It doesn't really get you a sense that, boy, it's really actually quite dangerous here. Or it's beautiful here. Or it's fresh air. Or there's a wildfire here. Okay? Now, I'm not suggesting at this point that we add some sort of score of music to GIS. However, there are some ideas I think might work for representing data through music. Okay? Maybe representing especially temporal data through music, since music happens in time necessarily, melodies occur in time. If you imagine something that doesn't change very much, perhaps the pitch of the represented, the pitch of whatever you're listening to might not change a lot. If it is cyclical, maybe it's the flight of the bumblebee going up and down and up and down and up and down. Okay? We might be able to make a melody out of data. Okay? It's a way of It's a way of incorporating other sorts of modalities other than your vision, which could actually get very overtaxed in visualization. We'll call it something other than visualization. Maybe we shouldn't call it just visualization. Call it some sort of experience. And in fact, I say that it's called experienciation. I don't know. I'm not sure. But it's something other than visualization. We're using some other forms of modality. Certainly, in the virtual environments that we see, we can get tactile information, haptic information, sound, smell. What a weird concept. Okay. We're trying to create some sort of geovisualization that aligns with users' expertise, with their mental conceptions. We're trying to be affective. We're trying to tap into parts of their mind that aren't typically tapped into when we're looking at data analysis. Okay? We need to be sensitive to those individual differences, and kind of hard to know what sensitive means. I haven't done the tests yet, and we don't know how sensitive that needs to be. But it's something to certainly chew on as we are getting into geovisualization research. And adapt these multi-sensory channels like sound for different learning styles, perhaps. Okay, so just sort of to wrap up, and I have some other things that I could show you, but I really want to emphasize that my realm of geovisualization, and one that I'd like to promote, is one that really does have the user at the center of the study. Okay, we're designing these tools and these representations. They are highly technological. They are highly advanced. Mine aren't, but people are doing more advanced stuff than I am. And we're somewhat ignoring the users. And I shouldn't say that we all are. Like I say, I'm not the only one advocating for this. But it's certainly all these research questions that come with a user-centered framework of geovisualization design, I think, give a really rich research questions and a really kind of garden for cool questions to arise. So I hope maybe some of those questions have arisen in your mind, and we can talk about those now if you'd like. So thanks for your time, and thanks for having me again.
In geology, the law of superposition puts young things at the top, yeah. And we usually represent them that way in a picture.
Interesting,
right? When you describe that section, you always start at the bottom. The oldest
is that right?
First.
Oldest first, when you're describing.
Cool. Side by side, okay. You get this reversal.
Huh. So, I could use a geological map and text as opposed to my campground in Norway Road. No, I like that. Thank you.
When you start removing conventions and metaphors, mm-hmm. Decrease creativity, are there any Another factor is in the youth that are getting lost, and we feel like the problem is getting lost, right? Probably a good thing. But are there other factors that get lost in certain situations?
Frustration. users do get more easily frustrated, and as I said before, one of the advantages of designing things for experts is that they get much less easily frustrated by new representations. They still certainly prefer their old, and they have a lot of capacity to understand new things. So when I'm talking about creative thinking and out-of-the-box thinking that unconventional interface design might lead to, it's pretty much for experts at this point. And it's easy for non-experts to walk away from something that's unfamiliar with them. So. Yeah?
Do you use randomization to select which people to study in your experiments?
I do, yeah. There are various ways of obviously separating people into groups, and it's, in this case, doing randomization is difficult, as you probably, I don't know if that's sort of what you're thinking, but it's very hard to control for different, you know, for these individual differences. And in a couple of cases, I've gotten groups that have been what I consider randomly assigned, and then I take a look at their scores on their pretests, and sure enough, everybody in this group is really good at spatial thinking, and all the people in this group are really verbal thinkers. And it's just the way it all shook out, and it's hard to compare those two populations. But it's experimental design of these experiments is very challenging, and it's basically because the tasks that you're assigning them are purposefully very vague. What you're trying to do is the response variable, the dependent variable, is insight generation. You know, how do you define it? Yeah, maybe response time, maybe accuracy of the amount of data that they're understanding, maybe the accuracy of their responses. But you don't want to box people in, but it's very difficult to run an experiment where you're trying to control things, but you then wind up having a dependent variable.